Accession number 30392, Reel 1.
Jake Wright with Reel 1. If we could start with when and where you were born.
I was born in Uganda. My father was a government surveyor, and he'd fought in the First World War, joined his father out in South Africa after the war, because my father was a journalist running a, grandfather was a journalist running a paper in South Africa. Married a lady there, and then went to Uganda as a government surveyor. And I spent the first 7 years of my life in Uganda. Wonderful.
Were you schooled in Uganda as well?
No, no. This was 7 years. At the end of 7 years, in those days, they reckoned it was unhealthy for children over seven to be kept in the tropics. So I was sent back to England to a boarding school in England at the age of seven.
What were you doing for those first 7 years, though?
Those first 7 years, living in a place called Entebbe, but largely out on safari doing survey work, living in tents and grass bandas out in the savannah of Uganda. Wonderful. And carried around on my father's safaris largely, though I'm told at one time, at the age of about six, I walked 6 miles on one of the safaris, and I was very proud of that. But mostly two porters, rods on their shoulders and a chair on the rods, and I used to sit in the chair and be carried head high by them.
Did you have, at that age, much interaction with Uganda local population, and did you see how the interaction between the...
Yes. I mean, my mother was there always, but there was, when we were living in Entebbe, in between safaris, there was... local population, house servants and so on. And then, of course, out on safari, there were campfires every night with an armed askari to keep the lions at bay, and there were 20 or 30 porters to carry all the gear, and also experts for the surveying and going out, putting out markers in the distance for my father with his theodolite to do whatever he had to do. Yes, lots, and that was great fun. I liked them.
How enthusiastic were you then about returning to Britain?
I don't know. I didn't really have much choice. I mean, I knew there were tearful partings, of course, when my parents, every 3 years, they used to get 6 months' leave when they returned to the UK. And it was on one of these trips back to the UK. We went and we had nice leave. They found me a... preparatory school in Eastbourne, St. Anthony's, and they took a cottage close by in Wilmington. And it was great. But then, of course, they had to go back to Uganda. And I was left in the care of the headmaster and the headmistress of the school. Oh, but is this appertaining to the war? Yeah, okay. But I was very lucky because in Wilmington, where they stayed for 3 or 4 months, in my first 3 or 4 months at the school before they had to go back, their neighbours were a pair of spinster sisters, the Stoney sisters. And they took pity on me, so they used to come and visit me and so on at the school, and I used to go out and visit them. And the school holidays I used to have to spend at the school, but they used to take me out for a week or something like that at a time. And then, better still, when my time at the prep school finished, Ruth and Tony had moved to Suffolk, where they had bought a small holding farm of some 60 acres. And leaving the prep school, of course, my guardians, the headmaster and headmistress, were no longer in contact with me, and Ruth and Tony took over the guardianship. And so, from the age of 13 onwards, when I went to the Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, I was living on a farm in Suffolk, a small holding, you know, a few sheep, a few cows, lots of chickens, a little bit of everything, sheep, pigs, wonderful upbringing.
Had you enjoyed school? Had you enjoyed school?
I think I was neutral to it. I didn't particularly say, "Ooh, this is awful," nor was I particularly happy, I don't think. It was all right. I learnt a lot. Had a terror of a Latin master, appropriately called Mr. Skinner, who used to shout at everybody when they got things wrong. And when I sat the exams for the Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, I was told to bring all the question papers back so that, and then discuss them with the masters in the school so they could assess them all. I lost the Latin paper, never found it, Mr. Skinner.
Did you at this stage have any great interest in the Navy and the sea?
I wanted to fly. I wanted to be in the Royal Air Force. My father had a great thing about the Navy. I don't know quite why. In the First World War, he served in the army. The South African contingent, I forget what they were now. And so he used to, but he had a thing about the Navy, and he said, "You're going into the Navy." So I went to the Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, fine, you know. And later, after many years, I persuaded the Navy to let me fly. But it took some time. No, I was not particularly keen on joining the Navy, but it was fine to, you know, join a service like that. And the Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, was, yes, quite something.
How was that organised at the time?
The Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, at the time, you used to do 11 terms there. It was 3 3/4 years. And when I joined, you were put into the... Everybody who joined at that same time went into a term. And this was... I joined the St. Vincent term. And, you know, you went through that, and then the next layer of people joined, and they were the Drake term, and so on. Halfway through my time there, they changed the system and said, no. Segregating people by age is wrong. So we all split up into houses with people who were just about to leave and people who were just joining, all in one house. And I was allocated to the Blake House, which was quite nice because it was the best accommodation, but there you go. And they changed the system. I don't know why. I think there's a lot to have been said for that term system, where you really did gel together. You'd all join together and, you know, it was fine. But the house system was standard public school, isn't it?
Everyone in each term would be the same age.
Everyone in each term would be the same age. Yes, you'd all join together at the age of 13 and a half, and you moved up through the hierarchy of the college year by year, term by term. And, you know, when you completed your first term, you moved up one, and there were the new ones. Oh, dear. You know, those little people. Oh.
What about the course itself?
There was a lot of, obviously, naval subjects, like meteorology, navigation, and so on. But mostly, on the whole, it was genuine public school education. No more Latin, I'm glad to say, but, you know, a very good education. I'm very grateful to it. I don't know what the financial arrangements were. I'm sure my parents had to pay a school fees of some sort, but I'm not quite sure what. Probably much less than a public school, I think, and, you know.
Everyone was everyone obliged to then serve in the Navy after the...
Oh, yes. Yes, I mean, you were sort of signed up. Though there was one boy in my term, St. Vincent term, R.G.B. Barrow, who was very revolutionary, something, or, you know, didn't sit down to naval discipline and so on. And he did, in fact, at one time, run away from the school and took refuge somewhere in Devon with an ex-nurse, I think it was. And he was eventually hauled back. And he completed... No, he didn't complete his time, but then he opted out, or, you know, it was agreed that he should leave the Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, in something like his ninth term, I think it was, out of 11. And he went off, and when the war broke out, he joined the army.
What was the school discipline like?
Oh, pretty good, pretty strong, pretty severe. There were canings. I got caned once. the, what was he, maths teacher? English teacher, maths. A man called Weary Whit. I mean, Mr. Whittle, I beg your pardon. And I stupidly had scrawled up on the wall beside me at my desk, Weary Whit is a cheery old shit. And that wasn't approved of at all. And I got six strokes of a cane up in the gym from one of the naval PE instructors. It was a good discipline. It was fine.
How much were you aware while going through school, through the college at this age, of what was happening in Europe?
Not at all, really. Not at all. No, I don't think it was aware of it. I think probably in our 11th term, when war was brewing, we were probably aware of it. In fact, we did 11 terms, and that was due to expire at the end of the summer term, July 1939. And war was about to break out, which was known. So instead of going off for our 12th term to the cruiser Frobisher, was it? HMS Frobisher, which was a cadet training cruiser. Not safe to go to sea, obviously, and so on and so on. War was about to break out. So we did a 12th term at Dartmouth, being joined with the public school entry people who had just, you know, they were brand new to the Navy, and they did one term with us as cadets, including Prince Philip. And then at the end of that, at 12th term for us, first term for them, we were all promoted to midshipmen, and off we went to sea in January 1940.
Was it expected that everyone who'd finished the college was qualified to serve at sea straight away?
Yes, I mean, you went to sea as midshipman, which is very much under training. I forget how long you're supposed to do as a midshipman. 18 months, 2 years? I don't know. That's where I'm going to get very hazy and be an awful confusion to you, because I'm confused.
Mm. How much of the course then had been Navy related, seamanship and at the college?
We did a lot of seamanship. We did a lot of sailing. I mean, there were cutters and dinghies on the River Dart. We used to row a lot. All that sort of boat handling was part of it. As I've said, navigation course, and I think, and verbal seamanship. I mean, a naval practice, a naval history, of course. But I can't remember much else, actually.
What had been your reaction to the declaration of war?
It was happening. Something was just happening. It wasn't particularly, you know, it was just part of life, as far as I can remember. As far as I, you know, one just took it and got on with it. And it, we were obviously altering our, as I've said, instead of going to sea in Frobisher, we went and did another term at Dartmouth. You know, it was altering our lives. But we would have gone to sea as midshipmen on a posted to various ships in January 1940 anyhow. This time there were ships in battle preparedness.
What happened to you?
I joined HMS Rodney, battleship, in the Clyde. I don't think it was the first of January, early January 1940, as a midshipman. I can't remember now. There were other two or three others from my term from Dartmouth who joined Rodney with me, but there were already a number of midshipmen there, and we, I think about 14 midshipmen altogether on board Rodney then, and we all settled down in the gunroom as our mess, with a sub-lieutenant in charge of the gunroom, keeping us all in order, more or less.
How were you received by the crew?
I don't know, really. They were all used to, they already they were midshipmen aboard, already they had been ever since she'd been commissioned, and it was just another intake of four or five young midshipmen.
Was there any sort of initiation or anything?
No, no. The nearest we came to initiation was the... I said about 14 midshipmen and a sub-lieutenant in the gunroom, and we were all invited over to the non-commissioned officers' mess one evening for drinks, and they did their best to get us really, really drunk and so on. And so later on we thought we would get our revenge, so we invited these non-commissioned officers. Am I right using the term non-commissioned officers? You know, they wore one stripe and they'd been chief petty officers and so on. And we invited them over and thought, well, we'll really fix this. They're going to be very careful. So we laid out all the drinks and all the water bottles on table were filled with vodka. And so when they took a drink, they said, oh, top it up with a lot of water, please. So in we poured all the vodka. It worked very well.
They didn't notice.
Oh, we got quite some of them quite loaded, yes.
Would you be able to describe the layout of HMS Rodney?
Only that. All the gun turrets were up forward. There were three gun turrets, all triple 16-inch guns. So the forward one was low, the middle one was then higher over that, and then there was another lower one at the back. And the lower one at the back, of course, couldn't point the guns up forward. They were sort of for broadsides and so on. There were also 6-inch guns on the beam either side. I forget how many. I think there were three turrets of those on the port side and on the starboard side. I know that the base of it, one of the 6-inch turrets came down right through the gunroom. And, you know, it was very noisy. But you, and in those sort of states, you could fall asleep on the settle in the gunroom right beside the 6-inch turret, and you were so tired you slept right through it.
What were your duties as the daily duties as a midshipman at that stage?
As a midshipman then, I was appointed to be the torpedo officer's assistant runner. And whenever he was on duty, I was on duty with him, you know, making the tea and carrying messages and so on. And at sea, it was a 3-watch system. And always on the bridge, there was the officer of the watch and also with him an armaments officer, either the gunnery officer, the torpedo officer, or a navigation officer, somebody else as well. So the officer of the watch was actually in charge of the immediate running of the thing, and the superior armaments officer would take final decisions about things. And, you know, one went with them when we were at sea. I'm talking when we were at sea, of course. And one in 3 watches. And that was it, you know, wherever we were going. Keep in contact with the lookouts and so on. Check the armaments were manned and so on.
What was the ship itself doing at that stage?
I have no or very few... We were based in Scarpa Flow. I mean, I joined it in the Clyde at Greenock, and we moved up to Scarpa Flow, and we were in and out of there and going to sea from there. And I really cannot remember particularly what we were doing until the Germans invaded Norway. And there were British forces ashore in Norway. I think British Army were. And certainly they didn't hear the Norwegians were fighting them. And we, in Rodney, went over to back up the land forces. I think they were British, but maybe it was Norwegian. And I think we even were called upon at some time to bombard targets that they decreed, but it's a long time ago, and I'm senile, and I can't really remember if we actually used our armaments in that condition or not. But we were there, and there were many other ships there as well. And Narvik is fairly far north in Norway.
Were you given any extra uniform or specific clothing for the...
Yes, we had... duffel coats. Wonderful duffel coats. Love them. And I owe a great deal to my duffel coats. Because the sleeve came right down to there. And my head was sunk in it like that at times.
What was the ship's spirit like? Of
what was what?
The HMS Rodney's ship's spirit.
Spirit?
Among the crew.
I don't know. I'm not in a position to say. I'm sorry. I'm not much used to in this sort of thing. Very, as far as I was aware, balanced, and you know, we were British Navy, and we got on with the job, and that was it.
Do you know how large the crew were?
I would think somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000, but I really don't know. That's my guess, based really on the Bismarck's crew having been 2,200, and I think we were a smaller crew than that. But I don't know. I don't know.
For how long were you in support of the Norway campaign?
I am not in a position, because I don't know when we went over. There must have been end of March, beginning of April. And on April the 9th, 1940, a Messerschmitt 110 dive bombed the Rodney. I better go back a bit. When the air raid alert was called, I was on the bridge with a torpedo officer. This is in my tape, but I'm repeating. And he said to me, "Well, we're not going to fire torpedoes at the German aircraft. Right, go down below and take shelter below the armored decks." So I went on down, but by the time I got down, all the armoured hatches were closed. So I didn't know what to do. So I went and sat in the gun room, at the table there, and fell fast asleep. And the MA-110 dive bombed the Rodney, and I think it was a 1,000-pound bomb, came right through, hit the Rodney. And next thing I knew, I was sitting on the deck, propped up by somebody behind me, and I couldn't see what was going on. I couldn't see at all. And somebody in front of me was, I think, cutting off my clothes or something. And I said, "Forgive me." I said, "I can't fucking see my fucking eyes. My fucking hands are on fire. Why can't that fucking, what's fucking going on?" And a voice in front of me said, "Steady on, old chap, that's the padre behind you propping you up." And then I passed out again, I suppose, I don't know. But that was April the 9th, and I think Rodney went back to Scapa Flow within days after that.
Did you ever find out what had actually happened to you?
Well, yes, I mean, I was sitting at the table in the gun room, and on the left was the pantry. And the story is that the bomb came down and through the pantry hatch and then down through the deck beneath me. But luckily, again, this is guessing, thought, maybe story, that underneath the gunroom was the machine workshop. And it is thought that that bomb hit one of the steel arms of one of the drills or machines, and so split and broke, so that instead of exploding, it burnt. And if it had exploded, I wouldn't be here talking to you now. And, there we go. That's an estimation, guess. It's a good story, anyhow.
And then you were hospitalised in Aberdeen?
Yes. I mean, when we got back to Scapa Flow, I remember being hoisted out of Rodney on lying on a sort of flat stretcher thing, being hoisted up. And as we went up, I was aware of the light on top of the crane. My eyes, of course, were all burnt, eyelids all burnt shut and couldn't see, couldn't get through them. But at least I was aware of light up there, so I knew I wasn't blind, which was a great relief. And yeah, and into a hospital ship, whose name I don't know. And then down to Aberdeen and taken ashore to Kingsseat Naval Hospital, which had been an asylum, which had been taken over by the Navy during the war. And I spent some time there, I don't know how long. And by that time, my eyes finally opened and so on, my eyelids opened up again.
What was the quality of care like, and bearing in mind that the war is...
What, in the hospital? As far as I can remember, excellent, wonderful, I mean... Well, yes, my hands were, of course, totally useless. As I told you, the duffel coat covered there, so just the fingers were burned. But, you know, I had to walk around like this, because if I did that, the fingers all got very pulsy. And I remember whenever I used a bedpan, my anus used to be wiped with cotton wool, which I thought was excellent care. You know, it was very good. And then there was a very wonderful Irish nurse there, who I got to know quite well. And eventually I was moved down to the Royal Naval Hospital, Plymouth, probably with a week's sick leave in between, I don't know. Sometime I had sick leave and went off to this Spider Hall, this farm in Suffolk. And then in Plymouth, it was, you know, the crisis was over and it was sort of repairing, you know, fingers. You used to dip them in hot wax bowls and bring them up and so on, because they were just like sausages, you know, no creases, anything in them. And plastic surgery, because a keloid growth developed in my eye and my lip and so on. And to keep me sort of in contact with Plymouth Hospital, sometime in the autumn, I was posted to an anti-aircraft battery, naval anti-aircraft battery, pom-poms, on, I can't remember the name, the head on the southern side of the Plymouth Hoe. And I spent time there, and, you know, and then into the hospital and out again, you know, sort of like that. And then, in January 1941, I was deemed fit for service again, and again, this is... Oh, terrible. Is that still working? This is where I get totally confused. When I left Plymouth AA battery, I thought I was posted in January 1941, I thought I was posted back to Rodney, but I'm not sure, because in May 1941, when the Bismarck was sunk, I was in the Maori, a destroyer. So I know that at some time I went back to Rodney, maybe it was after the Maori, but you know, I can't remember. Anyhow, I went back to sea, and the next memory now is serving in HMS Maori, which was a tribal class destroyer. Just a single midshipman aboard that and in the crew of officers.
Was there any sense of trepidation or anxiety about returning to duty at sea, having been injured?
No. That's what I think. Maybe I went to Rodney for a couple of months, I don't know, because I remember thinking, oh, it's very good of them to post me back to, you know, my surroundings that I know and the people I know. But as I say, I know that in May 1941 I was in HMS Maori. I don't know. I think, what used to be the War Office, the Admiralty, keep records of people's movements which are available now? In a way, I quite like to check that just to clear my stupid mind, because on that tape, you know, that's why I asked Richard Hughes, you know, can we please edit it a bit, because I'm full of confusions there, and say, oh, was I in my, was I, you know, and it's wrong on the tape.